Genesis 18 and 19 on Wednesday. By that I mean we covered Genesis 18 on Wednesday. And I was trying to decide if I wanted to trim some more stuff and make progress, but I really don't want to skip too much of Genesis chapter 19. There's a lot in this chapter anyway. So I figured we would just spend our time in Genesis chapter 19. I did leave some padding at the end of the schedule to because I knew we would be behind. And we're not that far behind if we do this. So I figured we'd just continue on where we left off on Wednesday night, where, again, Genesis 18 begins with this announcement of Isaac's birth to Sarah, and then the discussion between Abraham and God over the fate of Sodom, which leads then to these two angels coming to Sodom. This is, again, in the context of God telling Abraham, you know, an outcry has arisen to me of what's going on there, and I'm sending down, you know, these two witnesses. It's not his terminology, but again, the idea that God is not going to pronounce this death sentence until he has the testimony of two eyewitnesses that speaks to the justice of God, which is, of course, what Abraham's concerned about as well. And so the two angels come to Sodom in the evening. And this is the first time they are specified as being angels, I believe, in these two chapters. And that, of course, leads us to a variety of interesting things. So they come down to Sodom in the evening, and Lot is sitting at the gate of the city, the gate of Sodom. And Lot saw them. He rose to meet them and bowed himself in his face to the earth and said, "My lord, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet, and you may rise up early and go on your way." And they said, "No, we'll spend the night in the town square." He pressed them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house. He made them a feast and baked them loaves of bread and ate. I'll stop there for now, because I want to spend some time thinking about these first few verses. First of all, is this Lot sitting in the gate? This, of course, is a significant point of an ancient city. Not only is it the entrance to the city, of course, and one of the best fortified areas of the city, because it is also the weak point of the wall. The gate's always the weak point of the wall, and so it's simultaneously the weak point and the best fortified point at the same time. Ancient city gates were marvelously constructed in terms of strategy. They were always just about always built in a certain direction, facing a certain direction, with the gate going a certain way, that anyone who breaks in through the gate, they would kind of go, it'd be a double gate very often. You break through one, and there's another one over here. But the way that it worked is if you broke through the first one, as you're going down this kind of corridor, your shield side would be away from the wall. And so that opened you up to slingers and arrows and everything like that. Or you had to turn around and walk backwards to get through. So it's just the strategy is pretty remarkable. But in addition to all of that, it was the place where commerce happened, where contracts were signed, the justice seat of an ancient city was in the gate. And what all of this means is someone who was regularly sitting at the gate, and I don't know if we know for sure that Lot was regularly there, but anyone whose daily station was at the gate would be a man of standing in that city of some kind, whether it means he is a justice of some kind or whether he's just a well-known businessman or whatever else the case may be. People who were at the gate regularly were people of standing. That's probably the implication here of Lot as well. But what he is doing is not just using it because that's where he happened to be, but he's using this position as an opportunity to protect people. And it's an interesting thing to think through. I mean, I get two kind of conflicting ideas as I read through this chapter. One is the way that Lot does this. It doesn't seem to me to be an off-the-cuff idea, but something that was in his mind already. That when visitors came to this town, I need to protect them. Again, the ancient concept of hospitality is something that you would expect someone to do this sort of thing to help visitors out, to protect them from any dangers around, and Lot being this kind of person you'd expect it. And so I get the impression that this is something Lot would have done on many occasions to protect people as they came into Sodom from the Sodomites themselves. On the other hand, you also get the impression from what happens afterward that this is the first time anything like this happened. You know, I don't think Lot was really anticipating the mob that comes to his house or how to handle that mob. His first reaction, one of his first reactions is pretty horrific. regularly? Is it the first time something like this happened? Maybe it's a little bit of both. Maybe Lot has every intention of, when someone comes to this town, I need to protect them. But most people do not go to that town day and night because of the reputation. Again, remember, Abraham gets no information from God that he's going to destroy the city, except, I'm going to go down and check out what's going on in Sodom, and Abraham even knows what it means. And so it may well be that nobody ever stayed the night in Sodom because they knew not to go there for the night. Again, we can't know for sure, but it's a striking thing to think about Lot. Again, Lot, a righteous man, as the New Testament describes him, who was tormented by the things that he saw. You get a glimpse of that here. You get a glimpse of a lot of the foolishness of Lot in this chapter as well. But you get a glimpse of his righteousness here, that he's trying to do the right thing and help people.
Is that a normal thing to call someone by Lord and bow down? Do they dress special?
It's hard to say for sure. This would be a pretty standard sort of greeting. My Lord doesn't necessarily, it certainly doesn't imply deity all the time, but it can refer to that. It doesn't even necessarily imply any sort of, you know, monarchy or hierarchy or anything like that. The word can mean anything from God to king to master to servant. So it very well could be translated, sirs, please stay here. Turn aside and stay with me tonight. It's kind of hard to know where exactly in that semantic range what Lot's meaning is. My guess is it's probably just something like sir, a very polite way of saying sir. As to bowing, it's pretty standard in the Near East. Bowing is a form of greeting. So, again, bowing is not necessarily worship. Bowing can be worship, but it doesn't have to be worship. Here it's just a way of showing respect and greeting, I think. They say, no, we're just going to stay here out in the city square. And Lot, we're told, presses them strongly about this. He is insistent that they come stay with him. And it's not just because he wants to be a good host. It's because he knows that they just cannot afford to stay the night in the square. Now, of course, they could because they're angels and they really don't have that much to worry about as far as things go. But Lot is not aware of that. And I don't remember who was that said this. I'm pretty sure this is not original to me. But he doesn't know their nature, but he knows the nature of the people that are there in the city with them. And it is this kind of double not knowing exactly who they are. I mean, on the one hand, of course, you want to be good to God's messengers when they come down. It's a little bit like, it's really not that much like. What did we think of was, you know, a secret shopper coming in and reporting back to ownership. When God's angels come down, you want to treat them right, even if you don't know that they're God's angels. It's a terrible analogy, but you get the idea. Entertaining angels unaware, as the author of Hebrews talks about, he doesn't have to protect them, but again, it speaks to his character that he does. But he doesn't know that, but what he does know is who the Sodomites are, and wanting to make sure that you know, nothing is going to happen to these visitors who have come to our town. Verse 4, before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them. Lot went out to the men at the entrance, shut the door after him, and said, I beg you, my brother, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. Let me bring them out to you, and you do them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under shelter of my roof. But they said, stand back. They said, this fellow came to sojourn. He's become the judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them. And they pressed hard against the man Lot and drew near to break the door down. But the men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck with blindness the men who were in the entrance of the house, both small and great, so that they wore themselves out groping for the door. Let's talk about a few things here. All of the people to the last man were here surrounding the house, trying to get in, telling Lot to bring these men out so that they may know them. Now, the significance of this is in the context of Abraham's conversation with God. Suppose there are 50 righteous people in the city. We use 40 for 50. No, I'm sorry. Well, suppose it's lacking 5. we destroy it for 45. Well, no. Well, suppose it's 40. Well, suppose it's 30. Well, suppose it's 10. It's just 10. We know I won't destroy it for 10. And again, as we talked about, God's position is not being altered because God already knew how wicked the city was. God's justice is being shown because Abraham did not know how wicked the city was, at least to that degree. And what you find here is that, in fact, only Lot and his family were not corrupt. And I think you can make a pretty good argument that only Lot was not corrupt. Because of the four who escaped this, Lot and his wife and his two daughters, his wife is still going to die in the destruction of Sodom. And we'll see what comes of his daughters at the end of this chapter. And by way of spoiler, the answer is not that they're righteous. And so I think pretty clear, Lot is the only person in this city who is a righteous person who is not corrupted by Sodom. And again, remember when we last saw Lot with Abraham, as far as the text indicates, he was a single man. And a lot of time has passed between chapter 13 and now. Where exactly he gets his wife, he could have had his wife already, and we just don't know anything about her. I kind of get the impression that she was from Sodom, that he met her there. That's part of why she was turning back towards the city. But certainly, if the children are raised there, you can see how it has corrupted the entire family. Which brings us then to Lot, his reaction here, which is a mixture of bravery and cowardice, you might say. But the fact that he goes out and even face the mob. I mean, this is something that probably we don't give Lot enough credit for, that he goes out there and faces them at all. I think about the last thing I would do if everybody in the entire town was pounding on my door is open the door and go out and plead with them. And he goes through a variety of things. He entreats them. He begs them not to act so wickedly. He comes up with a compromise. And this is, you know, one of the most awful things that I can imagine anyone ever saying in this sort of circumstance is, I've got these two virgin daughters, how about I trade them instead? I mean, hospitality in the ancient world, protecting your guests, is a pretty noble thing, but I can't imagine anybody, even in the ancient world, thinking, you know, the noble calling of hospitality justifies this sort of reaction. I've heard people try to explain this away in a variety of ways as something other than just a terrible choice. People have said, well, Lot knew that, you know, they were so bent on this one particular sin, they wouldn't take him up on the offer. Okay, well, why is he making the offer if he knows they're not going to take him up on it? I mean, maybe you're stalling them and buying yourself 30 seconds. It really, what it looks like is Lot is genuinely trying to protect his guests. This is something that he thinks is a legitimate idea. I have a really hard time seeing it as justifiable in any sense. But again, it is in his desire to protect these men. Do nothing, whatever you do, you know, hear my daughters, take them, do as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof. Again, this is this appeal to the ancient idea of hospitality, that when someone comes under your roof to stay with you, you're not just giving them a meal and sending them on your way. You have become their protectors while they are there with you. You are caring for them in every imaginable way. And so in treaty compromise, he is appealing to their sense of duty in terms of hospitality. And all of this is rejected out of hand. And their reaction is, who do you think you are? You've come here as a sojourner. You're not even one of us. Now you're acting like our judge. And again, whether that implies something about his position at the gate or not, probably, you know, he may well have had some sort of position of justice, but I don't know if this implies it. But here you are, you're not even one of us, and you're acting like our judge. We'll do worse to you than we were going to do to them. And they're pressing hard against Lot. The angels reach out, bring him in, and shut the door. And I can't help but wonder if them shutting the door is a bit like God shutting the door of the ark. Not just the physical act of closing it, but more than that, that it is a seal of divine protection of some kind. That really is, again, I think we said this when we were talking about the flood. scene. It's not just that God physically closed the door, although that may well have been the case as well. But when God shut the door, he shut them in and kept them safe from the flood by closing them into the ark. Again, maybe this has the same idea, maybe it doesn't. But whatever the case is, they shut the door and they strike them with blindness. And it seems pretty clear that this isn't just physical blindness. It includes physical blindness, but it's more than that. And the reason why I would say that is because everybody in the town is at the door. And when they're struck with blindness, they can't find the door. My guess is if you put 50 blind people in our parking lot and told them to find the door, eventually one of them could. You know? Here is an entire town that is already at the place they're looking for and they can't find it. Which seems to indicate there's more than just that they can't see. Yet at the same time, they wear themselves out groping for the door. I mean, can you imagine being so blind, not just physically, but blind to the justice of God, that God himself reaches down and judges you, and it makes absolutely no impact on you at all? You've been struck blind in the moment of your sin, and instead of having any inclination of repentance whatsoever, you just keep on trying to get to that sin. And that's what they're doing here, which again speaks to just how wicked it is. Not just that every man in the town, young and old, every single one of them is here, but that when God judges them, it makes zero impact on their actions or their attitudes at all. And again, it speaks to the depravity of the city of Sodom.
What I was going to say, in conjunction with yes, I mean, even if they said, okay, well, let's go for that, you know, now you got that pretty good.
Yeah.
But between that, now that you have the fact that they were so persistent that even blind, even being at the door, they wearing themselves out. And if they surrounded the house, I mean, how big is Lot's house that going around the house, they couldn't find the door? So either, you know, God made it so that when they, quote, found the door, they didn't find the door.
Yeah.
Or it's a figurative, you know, they couldn't find the door, meaning they couldn't come in type of thing. But it just shows that Lot tried to snap them out, God tried to snap them out, and they weren't willing to see my disappointment.
And what's really sad is that this, I mean, it's just complete obliviousness to what's going on. We're going to see a little bit of that in Lot. Well, certainly not the complete immorality of these people, but the constant grabbing them and shaking them and it not working. We're going to get a little bit of this as well. Any other thoughts about this first scene here? Just for talking.
I know.
Go ahead.
And this is going to kind of into the next scene as well. If all the men were there, were his sons in law there, or were they there?
That's a good question. That's a nice segue. Let's talk about Lot's family and his sons-in-law that are mentioned here. The angels say to Lot, the men say to Lot, if you anyone else here, sons-in-law, sons, daughters, or anyone else in the city, bring them out of the place. We're about to destroy the place because the outcry against the people has become great before the Lord. The Lord has sent us to destroy it. So, do you have anybody else in your family here? And verse 14, Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, up, get out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city. But he seemed to his sons-in-law to be jesting. So who exactly are these people? You know, were they part of the mob? Were they already in the house? That doesn't seem to be the case. It seems that they're out of the house. He's going out to them. It's a little bit complicated to figure out exactly who they are. You know, are they, if they're not part of the mob, what does it mean when it says everyone the last man? It doesn't really sound like that's just exaggeration. It does seem like when it says every single person, young and old, all the people to the last man, that the point is to read that literally, not just as some sort of hyperbolic figure of speech. So it may well have been that they were in the mob, and now Lot is appealing to them anyway. Or they may have been in the house and went out to them. Doesn't mean went out the house. Well, there are a couple of ways that this is read, and it's complicated by the fact that Lot just got done saying his daughters were virgins. So how can these be his sons-in-law if his daughters are virgins? Well, you've got a couple of options. You've got one option, which is reflected in the ESV, the New American Standard, the NIV, the RSV, that they were betrothed to his daughters. Verse 14 reads in these translations something like, who were to marry his daughters, in which case they may or may not already be living in the house, but they're not married to these daughters that are there. In which case, they don't travel, they get destroyed in the city, but it's just two extra people in the larger family that get destroyed in the city. The other possibility, as reflected in the New King James, the Old American Standard, is who married his daughters. And either one of these is a legitimate rendering of the Hebrew. It's ambiguous enough, it could be translated either way, legitimately. In which, if this is the case, then there are other daughters in the city who are married to these sons-in-law. They may well have been out there with the mob. Lot does go out to them to find them. In which case, if that is the case, your verse 15, your two daughters who are here. We didn't get that far. As the morning dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment." Is it your two daughters who are here as opposed to your daughters who are elsewhere? Or is it your two daughters who are here just because they're already here? And again, it's all really hard to know for sure exactly how to render it. But what it boils down to is, are there other daughters and sons-in-law in the city that are destroyed with Sodom? Or were there just sons-in-law betrothed to the daughters, not yet married to them, but still would be counted as sons-in-law in this kind of culture that get destroyed in the city? But again, it's hard to know for sure. Specifying all of this is a little bit tricky here. Now, what's more interesting to see is Lot in this chapter. So, as morning dawned, the angel urged him, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who were here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city." But he lingered. So the men seized him, his wife and his two daughters, by the hand, the Lord being merciful to him. And they brought him out and set him outside the city. And as they brought him out, they said, "Escape for your life. Do not look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Escape to the hills, lest you be swept away." And Lot said to them, "Oh, no, my lords. Behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you've shown great kindness in saving my life. But I cannot escape to the hills, lest the disaster overtake me and I die. Behold, this city is near enough to flee to, and it's a little one. Let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my life will be saved." And he said to him, "Behold, I grant you this favor also, and I will not overthrow the city of which you've spoken. Escape there quickly, for I can do nothing till you arrive there." Therefore, they call the name of the city Zoar. So, let's look at Lot throughout this chapter. And again, this is the point where, I don't know about you, but as I read this, I just want to grab Lot really hard and shake it as hard as I can and ask him what on earth is going on in his mind. So this whole scene begins in the evening when the angels arrive in 19:1. And it continues before they lay down. So that very night, before they lay down, the mob comes to the city. They pull Lot in and say, "We're destroying this town." I don't get the impression in verse 12, 11, from 11 to 12, that they strike them with blindness, they pull Lot in, they shut the door, and they say, "Let's go to bed and we'll talk about what happened tomorrow morning." I get the impression that they brought him in, they said, "Go warn everybody, we're about to destroy this place," and Lot goes and talks. They think he's joking. And then verse 15, as morning dawns, wait a second, Lot, what are you doing? Maybe he's waiting for the morning to get a good start. That I guess perhaps that's reasonable to say. But in verse 16, but he lingered. And so the men seized him and his wife and his daughters, and they set him outside the city. Basically, Lot, he doesn't leave as soon as judgment is pronounced. Morning comes along, and they're urging him even more, and he's still lingering, so they grab him and drag him out of the city and place him out of the city, and they say, get out of here. This whole place is about to be destroyed. Don't stay anywhere around here. Get out to the hills. And Lot immediately says, oh, no, we can't possibly make it all the way over there. How about I go to this very place that you just said for me not to go to? It's a really small city. Isn't it okay if I go to this really small city? I mean, it sounds like something your three-year-old would come up with in terms of logic. In order to and ultimately, fine, you can do that. I won't destroy that city. And we'll see kind of the irony of what happens with all of that as well.
So we're going back to verse 14. When he says, appeared to sons in law to be jesting,
yes.
Is that a reflection on Lot in some way? Or is it a reflection on the sons in law? Or does it mean something else? It's a very odd reaction. Like, you know, he comes and says, the city's about to be destroyed. And their response is not, you're crazy or we believe you, but that's a really good joke.
I take it as a reflection more on them. Again, I see it a bit like being struck with blindness and being completely oblivious to the judgment. This place is so wicked that God is going to judge it and destroy it. Ha! Yeah, right. Again, it's just obliviousness to the state of the city.
And then with the we'll go into the town.
Is it not small?
Yes. So they say, don't stay anywhere in the valley, escape to the mountains. And then he says, oh, but can I stay in this town? Is the whole don't stay in the valley, escape to the mountains, does that kind of go back to the Lot leaving Canaan proper to go to the valley of the Jordan? Or is it like kind of telling him to go back into Canaan, the mountains area?
Probably so. I mean, it could be saying the mountains on the Transjordan side on the east, but probably it's driving him back. Into Canaan proper. The cities of the valley was kind of, as you indicated, its own little region, and Zoar, where he goes, is amongst that area. So I haven't thought about it in those terms exactly, but probably it would be driving back in the direction of Promised Land.
Sure. I was going to say, if the seven laws are part of the law, it just shows a lack of respect to seven laws had for Lot himself and his religion, if he were, you know, to say that. Or it shows Lot's lack of explaining his religion, explaining who God is, what God has done for him, which is one where the seven laws leave another state of God. So to me, the jesting part all comes down whether it's on the seven laws or not, is either part of the law. Because honestly, like if you came up to me and were like, God's going to destroy the temple, let's kind of get out of here, you're going to be like, and I mean, without any prerequisite of God coming down outside of the flood and destroying the city, I mean, this is case number one of God destroying the city, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, you could add to a judgment on that one, but it's not the same sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, it certainly is. It's there's not a lot of precedent for it.
Finally, that would be a normal, strange situation. Obviously, the men get wives; they're producing offspring. It appears that all the males have given themselves over to homosexuality, but I guess they're really bisexual because they're having children. And then it says, God overthrew the cities, plural, in which Lot had dwelt. So it implies that he also had dwelt in Gomorrah. But it says he lived in more than one city. Puzzles me that Lot would have stayed any length of time in a city as corrupt as Sodom. But he remained there, as you said, at the city gate. I don't know if he's trying to bring morality to the city.
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, what is his purpose there? We've talked about this before. You know, Lot seems to be getting closer and closer. At first, he's pitching his tent towards Sodom. Then he's living in Sodom. And now he's got a house instead of a tent. He's pretty well entrenched here. He just keeps getting closer and closer. is, and yet at the same time, the New Testament calls him the righteous man, the soul is tormented by the things he saw. Is he trying to bring some kind of righteousness to the city as well? It's really hard to know. I think it was Pauline said in that class on Wednesday, is it possible that the outcry that has come up before God has been coming from the prayers of Lot? Which is a fascinating thing to consider, but certainly it is possible. But it's just really hard to know. You wish you had, a five-chapter story on what's going on in Lot and Sodom describing some of this. And it's just hard to know. As to the cities that Lot had lived in, I don't know if the point is to be precise that Lot lived in every one of these cities. I mean, if, use Charlie's example, St. Pete, Clearwater, Sarasota, Lake Monroe were all destroyed. Could we broadly talk about that as the cities that we lived in without it implying that we lived in every single one of those places at some point? I think you've got multiple cities in a single area as part of the same general cities of the plain. Did Lot live in the cities of the plain? Yes. Did he live in every single city of the plain? Not necessarily. So, whether or not he lived in multiple different places is a little bit harder to pin down as well. So. All right. So let's talk about this in one other perspective. The angels say in verse 17, four things. Escape for your life. Don't look back. Don't stop anywhere in the valley. Escape for the hills. And Lot's obedience, which is, I think, perhaps contrasted to Abraham's obedience. He immediately asked to go where they just got done telling him not to do. And in particular, his wife will look back. So they do stop in the valley. They don't escape to the hills. Three of them at least escape for their lives, but one of them will look back as well. Ultimately, what's going to happen is the Lord is going to destroy the city. Verse 23, the sun had risen on the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew these cities and the valley and its inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But Lot's wife behind him looked back and she became a pillar of salt. And Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked down and saw Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land in the valley. And he looked and behold, the smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. So it was, when God destroyed the cities of the valley, God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out in the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had lived. Fire and brimstone, or sulfur, is the same thing as brimstone. Is it two different things raining out of heaven? One grammatical construction of this and that is for one of them to modify the other. So it could be either fire and brimstone or burning brimstone, burning sulfur. Either of those are grammatically possible. I don't know that we need to be too precise on that, but in terms of how to understand this kind of construction, it may be relevant in other places. Yeah.
So this would be the Dead Sea, correct?
Roughly. Somewhere down there is the general region of it. Remind me, I'll come back to that in a few minutes because there's something that maybe we're all, actually we're about to get to it. So everything that grew on the ground is destroyed as well. And notice in verse 28 it says he looked down on this is Abraham looked down saw the Gomorrah toward all the land of the valley and he looked and behold the smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. Now the smoke of the land can just mean the smoke that is coming up from the land. The thing that is striking to me about this is, you remember back in chapter 14 when the kings of the north come down and they're doing war with the kings of the south or the kings of the east and the west, is the way it's described. And some of the kings, the king of Sodom and perhaps in particular, falls, we're told, in these bitumen pits. And whether it means he died or he like fell in it or he hid in it or whatever else the case is a different issue. But what it gives you a picture of, this is oil-rich land. And you have a direct reference to something that is pretty flammable there in chapter 14. Is the smoke of the land to be understood literally that the land itself is on fire in some sense? And the reason that that's at least possibly relevant is because of the Dead Sea. And if you look at a map of the Dead Sea in the back of the Bible or something, you know the basic kind of oval shape of it. What's really fascinating about the Dead Sea is the northern portion of it. I don't remember the exact numbers. I should look at stuff before I came to class. The northern portion of the Dead Sea is pretty deep in places, a few hundred feet in places. The southern portion of the Dead Sea is no deeper than 6 to 10 feet all the way across it. And one of the possibilities of it is that this destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah lowered the level of the land. The burning away of some of this under the ground would lower the level of the land to extend the Dead Sea to cover up some of these cities where this destruction had been. Now, that is one among many speculative guesses as to what could have happened there. It at least is a plausible sort of idea to explain away, or to explain the geography of the Dead Sea, the depth of the Dead Sea, the great disparity of the depth of the Dead Sea from the north to the southern portions of that body of water. So, but yeah, it is down there somewhere. It's really hard to know for sure, but that's a striking thing as well, because you know, if you go to Israel, you know the Dead Sea is not lush and fertile and a beautiful land that everybody's going to want to go live there. Yet that's exactly how it's described in a lot of books in that way. And so I take it that this judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah and destruction of all of this land not only destroys the land, may extend the sea, may not, but also it is kind of a permanent judgment on this land. That it, no one is going to look at that land and see it the way that Lot saw it. Yeah, so that's the other possibility is, you know, it's a little bit, well, I guess that could make it that much deeper. Most, if you look at most maps, at least that I've seen, put Sodom somewhere near the southern tip of the Dead Sea. I've seen the location of Zoar in a variety of places. The one that's the most interesting to me about it is any, I know there's no archaeological support for it, that little peninsula that kind of sticks out in the middle of the Dead Sea. I've seen one person that suggested Zoar was there. Everything else kind of gets destroyed except for that one little strip of land. Perhaps a bit too ingenious for its own good, but it's an interesting thought where Zoar might have been. But what's most striking about all of this section of the text, I think, is verse 29. So it was, when God destroyed the cities of the valley, God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow. You catch that? Why did Lot survive? Because God remembered Abraham. And I can't help but think of that in the context of the fickleness of Lot in Genesis chapter 19. Can you imagine angels at some point wanting to say, forget about it, I'm done with you, you can die with the rest of them. Again, I don't know if they would have ever thought of that. I could see myself thinking that if I was in the angel's shoes, trying to warn Lot, and him not listening, waking up the next morning and urging him more, and him lingering and dragging him out of the city and saying, get out of here, and him saying, no, I can't make it as far as you want. Can I go to this very same place that you just told me not to go to? How about that instead? Go to a little city, you know? It's not that big of a deal if I do this one little thing. Forget it. You can die with the rest of it is what I would be thinking at that point. Well, if that even crossed their mind, it was not in the cards, because God was going to spare Lot for the sake of Abraham, which is what he in fact does. And then notice in verse 30 as we get to the end of this chapter, now Lot went up out of Zoar and looked at the hills. You catch the significance of that, right? Where did the angels tell him to go? To the hills. And what did he say when they told him to go to the hills? Oh, I can't make it to the hills. That's way too far away. There's no possible way. And so he leaves Zoar and goes to the hills, for he was afraid to live in Zoar. You know, oh fine, you can go there, it'll be okay. And now he's afraid to go to the place the angels gave him permission to go to, and he goes to the very place that he said he couldn't go to, that they told him to go to in the first place. And so again, you just want to grab Lot and shake him as hard as you can. So he leaves Zoar and goes to the hills because he's afraid to live there. And again, More information is what we want, right? Why is he afraid to live there? Is he afraid that God is going to ultimately destroy that too, in spite of the fact that God said that he wouldn't? Is he afraid that he's going to be blamed? You know, he's the one person that escapes all of this destruction, you know, survivor's guilt kind of thing. Expectation of all the people of Zoar is going to think he's somehow responsible for this. Is he afraid for some other sort of reason that we don't know, and there's no possible way of knowing or even guessing beyond plausibility of ideas. For one reason or another, he's afraid, and so he goes to the very place that he said he can't go to. And so he lives in a cave with his two daughters, and the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there's not a man on the earth to come into us after the manner of all the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, so we may preserve our offspring for our father." So they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father. He did not know when she lay down or when she arose. The next day, the firstborn said to the younger, "Behold, I lay with my father last night. Let us make him drink wine tonight, then you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve our offspring from our father." So they made their father drink wine that night also. And the younger arose and lay with him, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Thus both daughters of Lot became pregnant by their father. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He is the father of the Moabites in this day. The younger bore a son and called his name Ben-Ami. He is the father of the Ammonites to this day. Well, a couple of things here. There's not a man on all the earth. This is surely figurative. This is surely hyperbole. They just got done living in the city of Zoar. Unless it was an all-woman city, they knew there were men on the earth. So the point isn't that there aren't literally any people on the earth, but there's nobody here. This is where we are. This is where we're living. There's nobody here. There's nothing that we can do. And their solution, I would suggest to you, is the result of having lived in Sodom all their lives. When you live in a place like that, this is what your logic ends up looking like. Here's a perfect solution, they think, and not even realize that this is a terrible solution in every imaginable way. Yet it's perfectly fitting of living in that kind of culture for that long. Yet at the same time, in the narrative context, let me clarify, this is nothing in terms of actual justice, but in the narrative context, you've got to say there's some sort of poetic justice going on here. What had just happened with Lot and his virgin daughters in this very chapter? He offers them out to the mob without their consent. And what do they do to him? The exact same sort of thing. And the text is clear that Lot is not complicit in this in any way, except being willing to get drunk. He is not complicit in this. This is not a mark against his righteousness from the New Testament perspective. They are doing this to him without his consent. He has no idea they're coming in. He has no idea that they're going. This is their behavior through and through, and that's what the text wants us to see clearly. And there is certainly poetic justice here, which again is not to say that it's justice in any moral sense. But in the narrative context, you can't miss that. And they have these two children, and they're not even subtle about it. This is one of those things that if you've got a good footnote, or if you're familiar with a couple of Hebrew words, you might know that Moav means from the father, and Ben-Ami means son of my kinsman. So they're not even subtle about what they name their children. My guess is Lot could have figured it out anyway, knowing that there aren't any men around for any miles. But when the first one gets pregnant and has a child and names him from the father, it's pretty clear what's happening here. Now, it's also clear that this story is told not just to show the moral implications of living in a place like Sodom, but there's a larger purpose because both the Moabites and the Ammonites play significant roles in the history of the nation of Israel. These are, in a sense, cousin nations. Not as close as the Edomites are, but they are still cousin nations of the Israelites. And in particular, Moab is very significant in the biblical story, since Ruth is a Moabitess who winds up in the line of Christ himself. And so, again, when you think of the, God hates all the Gentiles sort of logic you hear from skeptics sometimes, understand that Gentiles are always welcome into God's people when they accept God. It's when they reject God and follow their own idols, that's when they are rejected as well. But God uses even the worst in his Moabitess, who does come to faith, as Rahab does as well, but a Moabitess whose nation's origin story is here in this act of depravity, yet she leaves her wicked nation and comes to God and finds a place in one of the places as well. So this blessing that will come to all the earth includes peoples whose origin is like this. All right, any last thoughts about chapter 19? That's another great question. The story of Lot ends here. And it's because Lot's purpose is done. He is no longer with Abraham. He's no longer in the line of Abraham. There are no more stories of Abraham interceding for him and his descendants and how they relate to God's people. Their origin story is told. Because the Bible's not tracing the history of all the people, I would imagine that either a little or a lot will happen.
Going back to chapter 18, where basically Abraham and Sarah do both the same thing. They laugh. But I think we can tell something of their motivations by their reaction. Whereas Sarah is the only one who was afraid when she got caught.
Yeah.
You know, so you can have a he could laugh with still respect, but unbelief. They both could believe. Okay, but she maybe had some sarcasm in, you know. I mean, she might have been blaming God all these years that she hasn't had a kid.
Right.
Second thing is, as far as the blind, striking them blind and not being able to see, if you imagine it's at night, there's a mob, and they're all, none of them were blind before, but now all of a sudden they're blind. I can see them not finding the door just because they're disoriented, they don't know where to go. But I think they probably a couple of them found the ditch.
That's pretty interesting. One thing I'll say about that, Abraham and Sarah, is laughter. This is another place where I think some interpreters are just so bent on preserving Abraham's righteousness that they miss what the text is saying. You know, we talked about this with Abraham lying down in Egypt. People try to read that in some sort of moral way as well. You know, he's not really lying. He's just deceiving. I've heard that I think is a bit extreme. I've also heard people say, well, what's happening is, you know, he falls down laughing. He's laughing in joy of falling down in worship. I really don't think that's what the story is saying. I can understand why, if you want to read hard enough and think hard enough, you can come up with that. I think it's saying he's, especially when he says, oh, this young man lived before.
Right. He doesn't believe.
He doesn't.
But you can have unbelief and still be an innocent type of unbelief.
Right. I think that's right.
Whereas she maybe didn't have that.
Right. And their reaction, I mean, her being afraid and denying it and God shutting it down versus Abraham immediately accepting what God says and obeying, that marks it out very clearly.